Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which, as I understand, there's a lot more of the unknown around lately. I would like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to the listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do that as a public service presentation. They don't charge us any money for doing that. Friends of friends. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I also like to acknowledge and to introduce my co-host, Harold B. Harold's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. Harold?
Hi, everybody. It's nice to be with you, and I just want to reiterate for one moment that Joseph has put this website together, rumradio.org, and the radio broadcast, as a public service. The focus is working with others. That succeeds when many other things fail, and that's our focus, our topic, and Joseph doesn't make any money through the website or the radio program. In fact, he's sunk thousands into establishing it and improving it, and so I enjoy being here. This is my way of giving back. For my recovery, I just celebrated 25 years on December 28th. So, and I consider each day of that a gift from God. Joseph,
how did you do that, Harold? 25 years—that's 2.5 decades. How'd you do that?
One day at a time.
Well, I was hoping for that one.
And helping other people, really, it helps me.
The key that I found to recovery is about getting passionate in service. That seems to work. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. It's pretty simple and pretty plain. We say alcohol, but alcohol is a drug. Remind you that this isn't AA. This isn't NA. This isn't CA. This is more like Paranoids Anonymous, if you were going to get into anything. We don't represent anyone other than Rum Radio, although most of the information that we divulge on the website and on the radio show comes from the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the template of all 12-step recovery programs. If you work in a 12-step, it came from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been trying to get my church to incorporate, to have AA per se in under their roof, and they have their own 12-step shtick. And so I asked them if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? Of course, I never get an answer. I'd like to start the show off with the third step prayer. It's found on page 63 of the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also called the surrender prayer. And I use this when I start with a new sponsee. When I get somebody who's getting their beginner's chip, and I ask them, have you had enough? Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? And if they answer yes to those two questions, I tell them they can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit. But there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I ask them to do is to get a home group and to get men's names, boys with boys and girls with girls. This is not about romance. This is about life and death. But if that works out, that you can't get the same gender, and it's easier to relate to the same gender, you work the steps. We do the best we can with the information and the resources available. We work the steps. And one of the first goals I give them to do, one of the first assignments, and I always tell them why, is to call up some fellow on that list, their lifeline list, and get permission to read the third step prayer. And the reason I have them do that is to get permission is to pick up the 500-pound telephone and ask for help. To connect up with their home group, which is their lifeline group. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. This is going to, the third step prayer also encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And, of course, the fellow that he's calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink of alcohol, and chances are he will not. But there's no guarantee with this, but your sponsee's already into service. Oh, and I also give him Clancy 7 questions before I take him on. And it's a little, like a mini fourth step. And if I get those, I hand them the questions, I carry them with me. I believe luck is no more than having when preparation meets opportunity. And I ask him, I need these questions answered, and I need them back. Doesn't matter how he answers them. I just want to make sure that he's willing to take simple instruction, and he is willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety. Now, I get him back, we're ready to go. If I don't get him back, I'm not concerned. He's either not ready or he's not ready for me. In either case, that's okay. I assure them I'm willing to put in as much effort and energy as they are, no more, no less. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Give me the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen. Thank you, Joseph.
We have a really special, well, everybody's special, but this is extra special interview tonight. Dr. Jamie Marich. She's a clinician in the recovery field. Her niche is trauma in the 12 steps. I want Jamie, is there? Did I lose you?
Yes, I'm here. I just had to unmute my phone. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine. Thank you.
Yeah, I didn't want you to pick up on any resonant noise during your opening there. I'm so glad to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I'm real excited. Harold's also a clinician. And I like to tell people that I have no certificates of understanding. I have no degrees, no letters after my last name, but I have spent the night at a Holiday Inn Express.
So I'm always interested. School of Hard Knocks. I respect that.
I'm a nobody, so I don't put on any airs at all. So my knowledge comes from experience, and that's it. You know, and
right.
I'm a student. I like to consider a perpetual student, where I believe every man, woman, and child is my teacher. And as long as I can keep to that, I get a sense of somewhat of humility. You know what humility is, right? Humility is like underwear. It's essential,
yes.
Unless it shows, then it becomes indecent. Anyway, you were going
to
say?
I just wanted to voice my agreement with that.
Okay. So tell us now, you got into this field, and everyone has a direction in life, and you're very enthusiastic and passionate, and that's what. When I wrote to you and you wrote back, I could see that there was a passion for this work, for the 12 steps, and I'm sure this has evolved over time. When did you first find out that you had a problem with drugs or alcohol or both?
Well, actually, I found out during my first major job. I was I studied English in college, English and history, and I was working in the humanitarian aid field in the country of Bosnia after the war. My family is actually from that part of the world. So I went there after college, and I went to Europe knowing full well that I was crazy. You know, I knew I had issues with my head and issues with relationships in my life, and I knew that I had a drug problem, but wasn't willing to admit that alcohol was an issue. So, you know, I moved to Eastern Europe to work, which is basically an alcoholic's paradise, and as my higher power would have it, after 8 months of working there for a Catholic aid organization, this woman moved into the town I was living in from the States, from Ohio, where I'm from, actually, incidentally enough, and she had 25 years sober in a 12-step program. And I liked her right away. And, you know, there was something in her spirit that drew me. And we ended up talking, and I ended up having a lot of confiding-type conversations with her. Actually, my first exposure to any kind of recovery meeting is when I went with her as a translator, because she didn't speak the local language. And I didn't disagree with anything she was sharing with me. And it opened a door for me to have some conversations with her about my own life, about my own struggles with substances. And it was while I was working over there that I started going to meetings. I started working on myself, was eventually able to admit powerlessness over both drugs and alcohol, and it was there that I entered recovery.
That is interesting.
Yeah. You say, Harold?
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this lady did a 12 step, or you just felt a draw to her?
It was a little bit of both. I always say, and I write about her quite extensively in my book, that she didn't, I say that because she worked her 11th and 12th steps, that's why I'm sober today. You know, but I think that's one of the great ways of how she approached it. You know, she never tried to shove anything down my face. You know, at the time, I didn't realize she was doing 12-step work with me. But looking back at it now, you know, it clearly was her carrying the message to me, meeting me where I was at. You know, because at the time, we were just basically, you know, co-workers, colleagues, you know, when we met. But, you know, one of the best slogans I like about recovery is it really is about attraction rather than promotion. And, you know, I could tell you from day one working with this lady, you know, I wanted what she had.
She knew there was something wrong. Now, you worked your steps and you got a sponsor right away, or did you, what did you do?
Basically, when I was over there, it was a bit of an interesting situation. We didn't have a whole lot of meetings over there at the time, because this wasn't a pretty remote part of Bosnia. So where I was working, there were 3 meetings a week. And initially, I was like, well, do I really belong here? Because, you know, I don't know if I qualify for this fellowship or that fellowship. And she said, yeah, it doesn't matter. Just start coming to meetings. And I did. And actually, because of, you know, sheer lowness in numbers and people with, you know, quality clean time, this coworker became my first sponsor. And so I did go to meetings for about a year without actually maintaining sobriety over there, you know, but it was one of those keep coming back types of attitudes. And I would have, you know, 3 months of dry time here and there. And then it was, you know, July 8th of 2002 is what I consider my sober date. And I've had continuous sobriety since then. And it was at that point that I really made the commitment after some, you know, I describe this when I share my story. I basically was 23 years old at that time, but felt like I was, you know, getting ready to die. You know, I was just kind of exhausted. Because I think at that point, after having some exposure to recovery, trying to fight it and run from it, you know, it just made me more sick and more crazy in my head. So in 2002, that summer, that's when I made a commitment to actually follow all the suggestions she was giving me. I made a commitment to work the steps, and, you know, it's been a recovery journey since then.
Interesting. Can you take a moment and tell us a little bit more about the meetings in Bosnia? Were they similar to the meetings we have here in the U.S.?
That's a very good question. The first several meetings I started going to, you know, were actually begun by Janet, my first sponsor. So they did have a similar feel to, you know, what I now know of as meetings, you know, at least in Ohio. You know, some were, they were mostly discussion type meetings, you know, and the literature was read. And, you know, depending on, because there were a lot of aid workers at the time coming in and out of the country. So we often had people from different ethnic backgrounds there who brought their own, you know, regional flavor to the meetings. A lot of times the meeting took on a different, you know, flavor because they were, you know, partially Croatian, Bosnian, and then partially English. So we had to translate back and forth. But I've been through meetings throughout all of Eastern Europe, and even though there's, you know, some similar, you know, some differences regionally, it would be no different than, you know, regional differences you would have in the States, for instance. You know, the important thing is that the 12 steps are getting read at every meeting. You know, a lot of the vital prayers are getting read at every meeting, and we're all there to help each other stay sober.
I think it's amazing to think of the fact that all over the world, people are getting together in rooms and deepening their conscious contact with God.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do most, at least at this point in time. It's just amazing. It's a spiritual program, and as we increase our conscious contact with God, amazing things happen. And that is all over the globe at this time. It's just miraculous. I love thinking about that.
It is cool. And when I tell my story, it often amazes me. I mean, to me, that just proves how much my higher power cared enough about me to really, you know, bring me AA on the other end of the world, basically. And I still think it's hilarious. You know, I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, which, you know, is a very short distance from Akron, you know, where AA credits their founding. And this social worker that, you know, ended up mentoring me in AA and sponsoring me, she was from Cleveland, Ohio, which is not very far from Akron either. And, you know, we're about an hour and a half drive away here in the States. And here, you know, we met doing aid work in Bosnia. And that's where I was brought the message of recovery. And, you know, to me, that shows that, you know, the God of my understanding knows what he was doing by bringing me recovery, you know, quite literally a world away. And just one comment about international meetings, because I have gone to meetings all over Europe. They, you know, AA is all over the world, but it's not necessary, or, you know, other 12-step fellowships, but it's not necessarily all over the world with the magnitude that we might have it here in the States. And so, because like I shared, at the time, you know, I basically had only 3 meetings a week I could get to reasonably. You know, we did some traveling and did some conferences other places in the region. But, you know, here in Youngstown, Warren, Ohio, I often stop to think how grateful I am that I have so many choice of meetings. Or, you know, how vast the internet is right now, because even 10 years ago, you know, we didn't have such access to online meetings or online support groups. So, you know, I'm just really grateful that, you know, whenever I think about how, you know, I only had very few meetings to choose from at that time, you know, that being here now, I could literally go to a meeting, you know, just about any hour of any day. And I'm grateful for that.
What do you feel with the spirituality in Europe? Friends of mine have been telling me that they're closing the churches down and that going to church is not a big deal in Europe anymore, or actually it's no deal at all. Do you see that edging God out in society there as well as in the rooms?
You know, I don't know if I'm an intelligent one to comment on that, because, again, it depends where you're talking about. You know, Europe's a big place, just like the U.S.
Right.
is a big place, and you would have certain communities, you know, certain countries that might place greater value on conventional church. I definitely think, you know, like here in the States, even though there are some places, some communities where it seems like God is being edged out, there are other communities where, you know, young people especially are hungry for spirituality and hungry for connection with God. You know, and some people get it in churches, some people get it in the rooms. You know, so that's just my observation.
Now you've come up with the trauma. Now, traumatic, mm-hmm. usually people who've been in conflict, military. I know Vietnam was a big deal, and then soldiers who've been in armed conflict have trauma, and then of course that's still from the Vietnam era, it's filtered down into people in everyday life having traumatic experiences mm-hmm. and being addressed. How do you interface that with the 12 steps?
Sure. Well, just to clarify, you know, when we talk about trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder, we often think of the Vietnam War, of course. And Vietnam was very important in bringing post-traumatic stress into the public discussion that, you know, this is an issue that people who've been traumatized, you know, deal with great psychological pain. Although, as all of us are aware, trauma was certainly not a new phenomenon to Vietnam. I mean, you know, since the dawn of time, people have been calling it one thing or another. And one thing the field now has strived to understand, especially those of us who work with trauma, is that, yes, you can have life-threatening traumas, things like a war experience, a combat experience, for instance, a car accident, you know, surviving a major disaster. Or you can have what a lot of us call small T traumas, which basically means the trauma is not necessarily life-threatening, but it certainly can be life-altering. And common examples of that would include, you know, verbal abuse, for instance, growing up in an alcoholic home where there was no physical violence but a lot of emotional violence, divorces, you know, loss of a child or a loved one, you know, loss of a job. You know, a lot of things can definitely qualify as a trauma because trauma, if you look at its word origin, simply comes from the Greek word meaning wound. So if you're looking at the broad definition of trauma, you know, it's pretty clear to see that just about anybody coming into recovery has had some experience with trauma. You know, for some people, the impact of it has been more pervasive than others. And one thing that my work is, you know, really strives to integrate is to see how helping people in conventional 12-step recovery better understand trauma can help us to more effectively work with others. Because the reality is a lot of people in the rooms of recovery have unresolved trauma issues that can prevent them from really diving deep into working a program. Just to give you an example, a very common pitfall people have are doing a fourth and fifth step. You know, and part of my work, it certainly isn't excusing people from doing fourth and fifth steps because I think they're absolutely vital to healing and working in the program. But somebody with significant unresolved trauma, really of any kind, might look at the fourth or fifth step just as this completely daunting task. So being sensitive to that, you know, is part of what my work looks at. And as a professional, you know, it's like, how can I help you deal with some of this trauma so that you can, you know, go on to do a fourth and fifth step in a way that will help you. So that's just a little bit of an example of how I integrate, because I love 12-step recovery. I love, you know, a lot of what the field has given us over the years. But I also know that from the mental health perspective, we've learned a great deal about trauma as well. And we certainly can't ignore that.
Well, in that sense, I mean, isn't just living traumatic, you know, for most?
Oh, it definitely can be. Yeah, I mean, especially if you're looking at the broad definition of trauma. But the key here is, you know, the reason certain people can have issues with it is if it, you know, goes unresolved, if it goes unprocessed is a word we often use. Because, yeah, definitely, you know, there are wounds in and out of daily life. And if wounds get healed, you know, we could go on living pretty unaffected. You know, if we have resilience or if we have resources in place to help heal those wounds of daily living. And I would certainly, you know, argue that the 12-step program is a way that can help people deal with the trauma of daily life. But, you know, a lot of people coming into the rooms of recovery have just been obliterated with trauma in a way that, you know, we really need to help people address that. And sometimes the 12-step program can help, but sometimes they may need a little extra outside help as well.
And, Doctor, can you take a moment to give us a brief overview of what a person is like before and after they've processed their trauma? Just an overview.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It, you know, it manifests in a variety of ways, but there are basically four general symptoms that we see in somebody who has not processed their trauma. The first is this pervasive sense of, like, always wanting to relive or always being compelled to re-experience the event. You know, sometimes we see that happen in flashback streams. For some people, it manifests in, like, getting into the same types of unhealthy relationships.
that maybe mirror the original traumatic relationship. And that's certainly a theme we see with a lot of recovering people. A second symptom area we look at are avoidance strategies. You know, people who have unresolved trauma definitely have a tendency to avoid. You know, that can be locking themselves up in their apartment, not wanting to come out. It could be avoiding by using the drugs and alcohol, because the trauma can kick up such body-level distress that unresolved trauma can make people jumpy, make people anxious. And seeking out comfort through something like drugs, alcohol, problematic sexual behavior, you know, even compulsive shopping, smoking, gambling, you know, you name it, can give a person that temporary sense of body relief to avoid. So we have the re-experiencing, the avoidance. Another major symptom area is what we call heightened arousal. Basically, when a person is always jumpy, always on guard for something bad to happen, heightened arousal can also show itself as like intense anger, you know, intense irritability, this flying off the handle, being very easily triggered. And then another kind of symptom area we look at is, has the person's sense of perception about the world been changed? For example, trauma can leave people with very negative messages about themselves or the world, like I'm not good enough, or I'll never be safe in the world, or I'm just never going to amount to anything anyway. So a person doesn't necessarily have to have all of these symptoms to have unresolved trauma be an issue, but we usually see a combination of these symptoms kind of come out in people who have things that are unresolved.
So if I know someone who has those symptoms, what sort of process could they go through to overcome some of that?
Sure. You know, another very good question. You know, if you're talking specifically to people who would be quote-unquote non-professionals, you know, but are certainly in an ability to help people, like in a 12-step program, I mean, I think the key is you can meet them where they're at, first of all, and just engage in some normal human conversation. You know, a great question is, help me understand, you know, maybe why, you know, what's making recovery a struggle, you know. Not necessarily pushing for all the details of the trauma, because that could do more harm than good. But, you know, just showing that you care enough to hear about why, you know, working the 12 steps may be a block is an excellent first step. Listening is incredibly valuable. You know, being human is incredibly valuable if you see a person manifesting these symptoms. You know, even as, you know, Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, has said, you know, a lot of times outside help is essential. And if you are seeing a lot of these symptoms, you know, I think it's definitely worth broaching, you know, have you considered seeking a counselor or seeking, you know, some kind of outside treatment? Yeah, and yeah, for these issues. And there are a lot of mental health resources available to people at this point that could possibly help. You know, for a lot of people, working the steps and working with others can help resolve a lot of these trauma symptoms. You know, it's not necessarily an issue of outside help being needed. You know, it kind of depends on the person. But I think as sponsors, having an awareness, having a sensitivity to the fact that unresolved trauma may be a part of the person's story is such an important posture to take, as opposed to just, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, work these steps. Because one thing that I have found in my work, and a lot of us have found, is that having compassion and understanding, not necessarily letting people off the hook, but having compassion and understanding for what they've gone through. And even if you can't understand it, you know, having this sense of regard for a person's story can be massively healing to someone with unresolved trauma.
So years ago, one of my I hate meetings. They make me want to use. I don't like going to meetings. I just end up wanting to use at the end of the meeting.
Mm-hmm. In terms of if somebody is telling me that, it's an interesting thing, because on one hand, yeah, you do hear that as an excuse from time to time. But for some people, that is a legitimate concern. And my biggest way that I would approach somebody, either as a client or as a sponsee in that situation, is, well, Do you mind if I explore that with you a little more? You know, what is it specifically about the meetings that makes you want to use? And, you know, it could be something as simple as, well, all the drug talk, I just start to feel those cravings again. And, for example, you know, as a counselor, I might ask a person, well, then how can I help you better regulate your body when you hear those things said at meetings? A lot of what I go over with my clients, for instance, is, well, how can you, you know, better work with your breath? Maybe what are some types of like muscle clenching and releasing strategies we can do? There's some wonderful strategies with like tapping your feet on the ground that can help, you know, kind of release some of this tension. Because I do think meetings can trigger people. You know, I don't totally write that off as, oh, you know, you're just using it as an excuse, although it can be. So, you know, I definitely think exploring that statement when you hear it is very important. And if it is, you know, an issue of a person, you know, feels triggered, how can I best help you through that? So that would kind of be my general way if I heard something like that.
What would be key statements? You know, like, okay, so I'm sponsoring somebody and I'm trying to, do I actually try to develop the idea that he might be had a trauma, or I'm just listening to him? Or are there certain key statements that he would say that would trigger the idea that it's traumatic, that he's had a traumatic incident? Questions? Are there questions to ask him that would be germane, that would draw that out in your experience?
Sure. That's a good question. And if we're addressing that for sponsors, my key thing is, first of all, look at nonverbal reactions first. You know, if you notice that a person seems to kind of check out or zone out when a certain thing is talked about at a meeting, or if maybe you're talking one-on-one with a person and you notice that, you know, just that sense of like nonverbal discomfort, maybe I'm glancing off, you know, a good question I often ask is there something that's coming up for you? You know, either something that I said or something that you heard at the meeting. You know, is it triggering something for you? And I think that's a very good question to just kind of ask. And I often tell people, you know, if it is, I don't need to know every dirty detail, because I think that's key, just so that you're not forcing a person to share everything before they're ready.
Right.
But I often ask that question, you know, is that bringing something up for you? If a new person in recovery, for instance, is sharing about, like, oh, I heard this, you know, statement at a meeting, let go and let God, and I really didn't like that. You notice them kind of getting very reactive to it. You know, I might ask the question like, well, what's this really about? You know, or is this triggering something for you? And it can usually open a great gateway of dialogue that might reveal the presence of an unresolved trauma. Because, you know, if you're very human about it, you don't really need to directly ask, well, have you been traumatized, or, you know, did something bad happen to you? And I'll just, if I can, I'll share a story from my own recovery. You know, when I first started working with Janet, my sponsor, you know, and she was just wonderful, because she knew from her intuition and her experience that in addition to being, you know, an addict, I did have some unresolved trauma that was a real block for me as well. And one time she was with me and she saw my boss say something to me, and he was not really being, you know, nasty or anything, but I reacted so negatively to it. I started crying. I basically broke down. And she was very compassionate, kind of hugged me, and she told my boss, it's okay, I'll take Jamie and we'll figure this out. And, you know, she was just looking at the way I was crying, and she said, Jamie, this seems to me to be more than just tears. This seems like it's post-traumatic. You know, and she dropped that word at the time. But it was the essence of, like, saying, Jamie, what's this really about? You know, this is more than your boss making this comment. This seems to be triggering something from earlier. And sure enough, it was. You know, it went back to an earlier memory with one of my parents. And the thing is, even now looking back at it, I forget what the specific memory was that it triggered, because I think that's a good sign I healed it. But it was just such a general approach, a gentle approach, rather, that she noticed, this seems to be about something bigger. So just having that real, you know, I love that question, what's this really about? You know, or what does this seem to trace back to? I think are two great questions that, you know, sponsors, even not just counselors, can use with people.
What's this really about?
Yes.
And what was the other question?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to ask it. I mean, it basically comes down to what's this really about, or, you know, what's this bringing up for you? You know, you could even ask it, you know, what's this triggering for you, or, you know, whatever verbiage you think the person would best respond to.
And this would normally come up, wouldn't it, on a fourth step? These are the questions that I think fourth and fifth steps are usually fairly intense. You know, the first three steps to me are just agreements. I believe you can do the first three steps sitting at a traffic light.
But for example, if I could just interject, the reason that a lot of people may have a trouble doing a third step is because they may have trauma, you know, surrounding church or higher power, or maybe, you know, mom was, you know, so religious. It just, you know, because I know for me, you know, part of my story was I had a lot of what I call, you know, spiritual trauma growing up, and it's a long story. You know, my mom was in one religious group, my dad was in another religious group, and they fought all the time. So for me, for instance, you know, doing a second and third step, even though, you know, now I look at them, you know, how you do as agreements, at the time they were very hard steps for me to take. So, you know, a simple approach of, you know, well, what's this really about, even before you get to a fourth or fifth step, can be, you know, tremendously helpful.
I had a sponsee one time, and he was brutalized sexually by a stepfather who was an evangelical minister. And when it came to doing the third step, he froze. And, you know, the whole deal with Jesus and spirituality was all convoluted in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to the point, you know, in the fourth step, and where it was, what was your part? And I had just heard this before, and I told him, well, your part is holding on to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, to let go. I wish I had more than that, but that seemed to be sufficient for his needs, because he's still sober, and it's been about 4 or 5 years ago. So, but this would have been great,
and I know for a lot of people the fourth and fifth step does serve that healing purpose. But I have also seen for a lot of people where they just freeze at the thought of doing a fourth or fifth step. And even though the fourth and fifth step can be healing, they do need a little extra help from a professional perspective, you know, usually, to be able to work through it. Because I know in my capacity as a clinical counselor, I work with a lot of people on their blocks that they need to work on before they can do a four and five. And I see that as a service, because I want people to be able to do fourth and fifth steps. I just think we often need to be sensitive to how hard it can be for people sometimes.
Well, it was really hard for me, I guess, which is good now, because now I understand it. But I couldn't. Mm-hmm. It took me years to get to the point. I would put it off, you know, just always had to wax the cat or walk the fish or make sure everything else in my life was organized, and never really got around to it, kind of deal. So I had made up my mind I was going to get the program of recovery through the process of osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
That's sitting in a room and going to enough meetings that the information would come up through the floor, up the chair, legs, up my ass, and into my head. And this way I didn't have to do the hard work that was required until life on life's terms put me in a position where I had to do it. Now, I want to get your opinion on something.
Sure.
Now, I came across this information several years ago, and I've been using it. I have it on the website. I have the fourth and fifth step as outlined by agreement in the big book and general 12-step ideas. And it's fairly, what would one fellow say, pedantic. So it's very detailed as to some of the understanding. And I think that's okay, because it gives you just some ideas. But this one fellow, I went to a meeting. That was over here in Houston. It was at the Survivors Club. That was named by J.D. He had 21 years at the time of sobriety. He looked like he was like 20 years old. I said, when did this kid get sober? When he was 1 year old? How did he do that?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he got sober in the Pacific group in California, Clancy Eyes home group.
Mm-hmm.
And his sponsor had taken him through the fourth and fifth step, and it was really unique. It was a document that had been around, he said, 40 years at the time, so it's like 60 years, but he couldn't find the document. It was an abbreviated fourth and fifth step. And the key
mm-hmm.
was brief, brief, brief.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he explained it was that all you put down on your fourth step was the name, the date, and the incident.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And no more than you could put on one side of a yellow legal pad.
Sure.
And then you would sit down, and when I sit down with my, and I've worked it, it works really well. When I sit down with my sponsees, we're not going to be at 5 or 10 hour fifth step because it's only one
right.
side.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is outlined in the big book. We're going to go over as we're sitting down together. So it's like,
mm-hmm.
I consider like lifting a couch. He's on one side, I'm on the other side. Instead of putting the whole onus on the sponsee, he doesn't really know that much, and who the hell is Mrs. Brown? So you get rid
mm-hmm.
of all that until you sit down with him. And mm-hmm. it seems to get him through the fourth step and to a fifth step really quick, and that's really where the spiritual awakening starts in. You know, and the 12 and 12, it says, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. So I try to get them through as quickly as possible. What do you think of that?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I like how you said brief, 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 because just like, you know, we alcoholics and addicts like to take everything to extremes, so too can we take to extremes beating up on ourselves. And that's where a lot of people get really stuck in the fourth and fifth, that, you know, oh, my God, I've done so much bad stuff. And I think the key is, when I work fourth steps with people, is if you can remember specific incidents, great. But, you know, don't feel you have, you know, if you can get the spirit of the offenses, the wrongs out on the paper, great. That's why I like that idea of limiting it. I'm also a big fan of, you know, it says moral inventory, and that includes some of the good stuff, too.
Yeah.
And I've also heard too, you know, my co-sponsor says this all the time, you know, the first time you do a fourth and fifth step, you'll do it as well as you can do it at the time. You know, the important thing is that you do it, that you make the effort. So, you know, I think even if it is brief, and then you do find out after you have some more spiritual awakening that you have to go back and redo it, you know, by all means do that. But, you know, getting through that gauntlet is what I think is absolutely important. So I would support that approach.
Oh, good.
And let me chime in with a comment.
Yeah.
Years ago,
sure.
I had a sponsee who was, he really wanted to be diligent and work on it very diligently. And so he would put 2 or 3 or 4 hours into his work on his fourth step. And he got to the point where he was so depressed, he was actually suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I said, no, we're going to limit this. You can only work on
mm-hmm.
this for 20 or 30 minutes, and then you have
mm-hmm.
to take a break. And I was really glad that I knew this fellow as well as I did, and he came out okay. But sometimes
sure.
the material can be so depressing that
mm-hmm.
people really get... they can just spend way too much time at it. So I like the brief idea for that reason.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The morbid reflection. You have a tendency for morbid reflection, deep
mm-hmm.
digging into all this negative stuff about you. And boy,
mm-hmm.
what a piece of crap I am, and over again. You
mm-hmm.
know, just come on. So, and then I do the positive inventory.
Oh, go ahead.
I do a positive inventory.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of the positive inventory anyway, but just to briefly piggyback, you know, a client of mine shared once, and she had significant sexual trauma that hadn't been dealt with, and she had tried coming in and out of the rooms for about 12 years, probably only put together about 3 months each time, and she said she never was able to do a fourth and fifth. She said, every time I tried, all I saw was garbage. You know, it was so depressing. And to deal with that depressingness, you know, I drank. And she didn't, you know, she knows she didn't have enough foundation,
you know, she tried to get the foundation with the first three steps in the support group, but ultimately she needed a little bit of outside help to work on the trauma. And one thing that I, you know, really worked with her on is, you know, let's do this proportionally here, because that morbid self-reflection is a real thing. And just to reiterate what I said, we will take everything to extremes, including beating up on ourselves. And, you know, with all the steps, really, 4 and 5, and especially 8 and 9, I think having a sponsor's guidance is so important, you know, because left to our own devices, you know, we can take any of these steps to, you know, some unhealthy places. And, you know, I know I couldn't have done, you know, any of the, you know, especially 4 and 5 or 8 or 9 without a sponsor's guidance.
No, you really can. That's why one of the reasons I put together the website, my experience was that most folks don't know how to sponsor. They haven't got a clue. Some people get sober because they wanted it so much, and the meetings were there, and they could get sober. And, of course, you know, I never met an alcoholic that really wants to do the work. You know, they want to – everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. So,
sure.
You know, they stayed sober, and now it's their turn to give back. And, of course, they'll agree to sponsor from what they've heard in the meetings or what little or no that their sponsor did to them, which really didn't matter because they were going to stay sober anyway. And now they don't have a clue what to do. You know, they don't go to 90 meetings in 90 days, don't have sex, don't do anything major, you know, call me every day, you know, and that's none of that stuff's on Chapter 7. I mean, none of that direction is there. But these are just parroting what they've heard in the meetings and what they think is supposed to be done. And now we turn into this revolving door recovery. You know, people aren't, they're not sticking, they don't know how to do the steps. They're not doing the steps. And then they're demanding what they know is the correct way to do it.
Yeah, and quality sponsorship. You know, I'm so glad to hear someone say that yeah, you know, there are a lot of people out there who don't know how to sponsor. You know, and maybe I'm just saying that because I have had two fantastic sponsors, probably, you know, two of the best sponsors I ever could have had. You know, Janet when I lived in Europe, and then, you know, my sponsor here in the States. And I mean, a lot of it is I purposely, you know, selected women with a lot of time, you know, that was very critical for me, you know, women who worked the steps, you know, who really got into the steps. And, you know, it just, to me, it just makes all the difference, you know, having that quality sponsorship. And so that I'm glad you provide those resources for people. That's a wonderful service.
I like to actually go the other way. I don't look at, you know, time is important. We pick up a lot of thread and a lot of lint on the way, but that's no guarantee of the quality of the recovery.
That's true. I would agree. Yeah.
And sometimes, I suggest to a lot of my sponsors, I have some guys doing it, most won't, to start to sponsor after they've worked the fifth step, to become a temporary sponsor, you know, because they have the motivation, it's all fresh, and you really don't learn the steps until you teach the steps. You know, and most don't, you know, they wait, well, I have to work 12. If nothing else, because now they've made the commitment to work it at 12, you know, even if they won't work it at 5. So now 12 comes and I say, okay, we're out of excuses. It's time to go, you know, go find yourself a sponsee.
Point. You know, I definitely think it's a quality over quantity thing. I guess I'm just speaking from my experience that the fact that, you know, these women had a lot of time, but it was quality time. So I should probably
call that
statement. And that,
well,
the odds were better.
The odds were better with long term because they've been around so long. They've seen what to do. The problem is there's been really no definitive resource. Now,
And I think this idea of support network is important, you know, the whole idea of sponsors and grand sponsors, you know, because if you get stuck sponsoring, you know, especially if you have, you know, little time, but sponsoring definitely helps, you know, talk to your sponsor about sponsoring, you know, get some tips in that domain. I remember the first time I sponsored somebody, I was terrified. And I had even told her, I said, you know, if I get stuck, I'm going to consult with my sponsor on this. Is that okay? and having that support system for sponsorship, I think, is just as important.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt. I think that's the key to this thing. Now, to change horses, your deal says healing the wounded healers. So in other words, you're coming at the fact that the sponsor is wounded, and is that it, or?
Well, yeah, healing the wounded healers, that's a new workshop that I'm going to be doing this coming year with Dan Griffin, who's another great recovery writer. He's the author of A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps. And one thing he and I have observed is that there are a lot of people who are working as, you know, who are serving as sponsors in the rooms, who are working as counselors in the field, who have not, you know, that they're doing a great service, but they have not even, you know, recognized the impact of their own wounding or their own trauma. And, you know, there's just a whole lot of unresolved wounding going on either in our field or in our recovery rooms. And we really want to help people to be able to better get in touch with, you know, what's this stuff I still need to work on? You know, what are the traumas in me or the wounds in me that I really need to work on? Because ultimately that's going to help you help others better. And, you know, it's going to serve you to live your recovery to the fullest. Because, you know, a lot of people get into this field because they've had experiences with wounding, you know, with addiction, with trauma. You know, a lot of people become sponsors because, you know, I mean, everybody who's a sponsor really has had some, you know, personal recovery or attempt at personal recovery. And sometimes it, you know, just because what we're getting at is just because you're a sponsor or a counselor doesn't mean the healing process stops. So,
are you going to be here in Houston? I'd love to go to that.
That specific workshop, I'm coming to Houston in March. And if people are interested in my work, my main website is jamiemarich.com. I have a full calendar. In Houston in March, I'm going to be presenting, it's a general trauma course I'm presenting there. Healing the Wounded Healers is something Dan and I are doing a first workshop on that in February in L.A. It's February 7th as part of the Evolution of Addiction Treatment Conference. And I also have a Facebook page. You know, you're welcome to share that on your site. It's, you know, Jamie Marich, and then I have the Trauma and the 12 Steps Facebook page. And I have all my events posted there if your listeners are interested.
How do we spell your name?
My name is Jamie, J-A-M-I-E. My last name is Marich, M-A-R-I-C-H. On Facebook, Trauma and the 12 Steps, if you just search that you would come to that page. And I also have a website, trauma12.com. It's just the word trauma and then the word 12, T-W-E-L-V-E. And I have a lot of free resources on that website for people, you know, especially for sponsors and counselors and for recovering folks. Just basically, I have some interviews, some articles that I've done there. I also have a couple guided meditation, guided imagery tracks that people could download for free on there. And I also have listings there about all the other trainings or events that I do around the country.
Interesting. Would you have any problem with me putting a link on the website?
Please do. More the merrier to share it with. That'd be wonderful.
What part of the – now, I have the 12 steps, and then I have a sponsorship tab, what a sponsor does and doesn't do, how to find a sponsee, how to find a sponsor. What area would you question sponsors ask about sponsorship? That probably would be the –
Yeah, that would be a good area, sure. Because my book Trauma and the 12 Steps, I not only wrote it for counselors, but I wrote it for sponsors as well. Basically, I've plugged the book as it's written for anybody who works with others in a recovery capacity, because I think a lot of the knowledge that we have, you know, I'm not, you know, saying I'm training sponsors how to be counselors, but I think a lot of the knowledge we have as counselors can be shared with sponsors.
Oh, absolutely. There's no such thing as not enough good information.
Sure.
You can, you take what you know, the whole, the buffet style, take what you need and leave the rest. I have one fella on the site, and I've never done it, but he goes through somebody. I have it under the section 12 and 24, Dr. Bob times 5,000. taking somebody through all 12 steps in 24 hours just using the big book.
Mm.
And I've never done it, and he's done it. He's got the videos are on there and all that, and he's had a tremendous amount of success. That's the real back-to-basics formula.
Right.
They would go through the steps.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
3 days. I mean, 3 days he was at Towns Hospital, which is interesting because you had a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief.
Mm-hmm.
With the first three in AA. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Doctor, lawyer,
interesting because I have a lot of people share that with me. You know, well, you know, in the history, people went through the steps quickly. And my general philosophy is if that works for a person, great. As a professional, I'm skeptical that the first working of the steps were necessarily quality. And because I'm a big fan of reworking the steps, you know, period.
Sure.
And I don't think I ever stop working the steps. You know, and every time I work them, you know, it becomes a new enriching experience. So, you know, it's definitely not something you graduate from.
No, well, you said to my sponsees, one has to be done perfectly. It's the only one. The rest of the 11
mm-hmm.
are ideal.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
And then you never really finish working three because you turn your will over and you take it back and you turn your
mm-hmm.
will and you
mm-hmm.
take it back. Endless cycle. Six.
And I'm delighted you start your show with a third step prayer. I need to pray that every morning. It's a fabulous prayer.
It's a fabulous, yeah, it really is. It's really inspired. You're always working entirely ready. Six, who's entirely
mm-hmm.
ready? Well, nobody actually is entirely ready. You could just
mm-hmm.
only be as ready as you are at any given time. So that's always on in play. And then seven,
mm-hmm.
God's going to take away your character defects in his time and in his way. It's not your deal anymore. And then 10, 11, and 12 are the growth steps. So
mm-hmm.
all these steps are really always in play every day.
Mm-hmm.
My experience, tell me this. Now, if I lose a sponsee, and it hadn't been a while, but if I lose a sponsee, it's usually on step six. Have you had any experience with that?
I don't know, because my experience has largely been four and five in terms of losing people. But in step six, I mean, I think a lot of that is our tendency to gloss over six and seven, as opposed to, you know, people feel, oh, I've been through the fifth step. You know, now it's kind of like I've made the ultimate. I could just speak for my own self as we know, one being sponsored. I know I felt, going through them the first time, I kind of ignored six and seven largely for the first couple of years. Not ignored them, like I think I worked them in lip service. I know when I was about 3 years clean, the whole drop the rock work became very important for me, you know, to help me see how six and seven really are the most daily steps that I work. So, and that's another step too, that working with my sponsor, you know, her guiding me, you know, and she guided me in a way very similar to what you just said, how, you know, who's ever entirely ready. And she pointed out my tendency to want to beat myself up too much on six and seven. So her guidance is what helped me really work them in a manner that served me.
Oh, great. One last question.
Sure.
When you sponsor someone, do you
mm-hmm.
divorce yourself as the clinician, or does that kind of just, it's, you know, because we really don't have a,
yeah.
A recovery plan. They're not our patients.
Mm-hmm.
They're our sponsees, and we all we can really suggest is our experience, strength, and hope. So as a professional,
mm-hmm.
does the line get blurred a little bit, or how do you work that?
That is an excellent question, and because I have struggled with some of that line blurring, I, to be honest, and I will out myself doing this, I don't sponsor a whole lot. I especially do not necessarily, you know, sponsor people who are fresh to recovery. I'm part of a lot of people's support groups, but I notice, you know, there is that tendency for me to cross the line too much. So, you know, as part of my self-care, I've decided, you know, I only sponsor some people who maybe ask me a little bit later down the road, because that helps me keep the two clear.
I'm also very clear to kind of out myself to people that I am a counselor, and if you're asking me to sponsor you, you know, you're not going to get free counseling necessarily. But, you know, how I operate as a sponsor, you know, there's inevitably going to be some kind of overlap. So I think all professionals in the field have to take a good look at what's going to work for them in turn, because I know a lot of professionals who do sponsor, and they are able to keep that distinction pretty clear. I know some who don't keep it very clear. I get worried for them. So I think it all comes down to that individual. But I know for me, you know, for people who are fresh in sobriety, I definitely am part of support groups, but I tend to resist being called a named sponsor. You know, and that's just the way that I help to keep it clear.
Oh,
so.
Good. Harold, do you have any last questions?
Well, yes, Doctor. I'm looking at your website. It's quite lovely, and that's a great portrait there at the top.
Oh,
the
you.
Website is jamiemarich.com, JAMIEMARICH.com. Just terrific. Can you take a moment and talk a little bit about EMDR and help familiarize our audience with what that is?
Well, EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. I know that's a mouthful. And basically, it is a specialty treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. I've done a lot of training and work in it. In my private practice, I do a lot of EMDR therapy. And it is an option that recovering people have. I usually don't recommend it unless people have a commitment to sobriety and have been working a program for a little while, that EMDR can really help with some of the trauma resolution issues that may need to happen. So, yeah, on my website I have some links to some EMDR sites if people are interested in reading more about that. My first book was on EMDR, mostly written for other EMDR clinicians. But it is an exciting treatment that helps a person integrate some of these body and mind types of traps that could come up in the wake of trauma.
That's wonderful. I'm looking at the cover of your book, EMDR Made Simple.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're talking to a person in recovery who has no knowledge whatsoever about what the problem is or how it can be solved, do you have a simple way to explain it to a novice?
To explain EMDR to a novice? Sure.
Yes,
what it addresses. Sure. Basically, it addresses unresolved trauma that is trapped in the very, you know, what we would call visceral level of the brain, meaning the deeper parts of the brain that we can't really get to talking about just with words, the types of stuff that will manifest like with those uneasy feelings in the stomach, maybe the racing heartbeat. It helps us get to the parts of trauma that express in the body more so necessarily than with words or the mind. And, you know, EMDR technique, explaining the whole thing is you know, a little more complicated of a measure, but it helps us use eye movements or other forms of back-and-forth stimulation. Like, you could use drumming or even walking, because back-and-forth motion is an excellent way to help a person get to that deeper part of the brain that words necessarily can't reach. If your listeners are interested in learning more on EMDR, a really good website I could direct them to is called EMDRinaction.com. And there's some demonstration videos there of how EMDR works, and it really is an excellent resource.
Terrific. That's great to have that overview. And people can begin thinking about that as a resource. I know one thing that I do know is that EMDR has been researched more than just about anything else I can think of because it's so effective, and a lot of clinicians have been trying to figure out how and why or even disprove it, but it is truly remarkable from what I've seen so far.
It is the most researched therapy for PTSD, post-traumatic stress. A lot of people don't realize that, but it does have such a resource base. And it is kind of mystifying even to, you know, there's a lot of theories amongst even the biggest brain scientists in the world exactly what it's doing in the brain. But, you know, I go back to a Native American culture, you know, in a lot of indigenous cultures, when people were traumatized, especially in a war situation, they engaged in either drumming or dancing. And both activities, you know, were called like a way to do shaking medicine, you know, to shake the demons up, so to speak. And, you know, anything that engages the body in a dynamic back and forth motion, I think that's what EMDR really is tapping into. It's great treatment, and I highly recommend it.
Now,
it takes
an emotional memory and puts it into a historical memory. Isn't that the gist of it?
That's a good way to put it, yeah. You know, it helps take the charge out of a lot of these memories. You know, EMDR is not going to erase memories, but it can help take you to a place of, you know, yeah, it happened, as opposed to, you know, I kind of decompensate or crumble every time this emotion.
Yeah, I freak out. Now it just
comes up.
Yeah. Yeah, I had it done years ago. I'm a Vietnam veteran and had post-traumatic syndrome, and it was early on. I was back, but it took me years to even to get to that point. And this was when the modality first came out. And I was really impressed with it. It really worked well. And at the time, they weren't sure. He told me the history of it and the metronome and the finger and all that. But the rapid eye movement, and all of a sudden it just changes. And I think the key was to relive the trauma during the best, and that's what the clinician did. He helped you to relive the trauma at the time of the rapid eye movement. And for some reason, it put it into a different file cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I very rarely even think of that stuff anymore. And even when I do, it's dismissed immediately, but it has no emotional effect on me.
Mm-hmm. It removes the charge.
Highly. Yeah. Takes it off. Yep. All right. So any other comments about your book or where to find it or your website, or is there anything else that you wanted to close with?
Well, just wanted to thank you for this opportunity. And if people are interested in hearing more, the best website I would send them to is thetrauma12.com, because you could link all of my other websites from there. But there's a lot of the great free resources on the Trauma 12 website. There's info there on where to get the book, and there's the resources there even if you're not interested in the book. And we also have the Facebook page for Trauma and the 12 Steps. So just go ahead and search that, and you could find me through that as well.
Trauma12.com.
Yes, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the well, I've learned something now. I'm looking forward to enhancing my knowledge as a sponsor. You know, anything I can do to do that helps me, and it helps the next guy and keeps me sober. But it's more than that. So, you know, we say that, and initially, and that's the case, you know, the one immunity is intensive work with another alcoholic, but it turns into more of a spiritual passion of really enjoying when the light comes in the eyes of somebody you're working with, you know, and it's sponsor's job to me is to be there to as a guide to God, to His higher power, and that's all the sponsor's supposed to do is a guide. But I tell my sponsees initially, most of the fellas I deal with end up attaining and maintaining long-term sobriety, which is true. So if nothing else, they know that they can count on me for a short period of time, but I try to get them to just depending on the program and onto God as soon as I can, and then cut them loose once they work the steps. Okay, big guy, you got all you need. It's time to get into the trenches and get to work. And if they do that, they take those simple instructions, it works, folks. It really does. Harold, any last words?
Well, I appreciate the conversation tonight, and I, too, have learned a lot. I like to tell new people that one of the things we're doing here is preparing you to help somebody in a little while, to help somebody who is newer in the program than you are. That's where things really come into focus. And so Well, I've enjoyed this a lot. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much. You both have a happy new year. God bless.
Happy new year, yes. And in closing,
bye-bye
I'll say, bye. Rumradio.org. We're in 150 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're over 200,000 hits to the website in 2,600 towns, cities, and villages. And there's no money being made, and we're anonymous to the 11 tradition. If you want some good information on sponsorship, the resources available, all you have to do is click on and take a little effort and read. And what we ask you to do is use the tools laid down at your feet, open your mouth, and pass it on. So, Happy New Year, and we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Goodbye.